Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the CalcioLand podcast. And this is brought to you by our great friends at Euro Fantasy Game, where you can play multiple fantasy football games. The international break is mercifully coming to an end. You can get your Serie A, Premier League, La Liga, even Dutch League fantasy football fix in at Euro Fantasy Game. You can also read a lot of excellent articles on Serie A. In the past few days, I wrote about salaries in Serie A, who's overpaid, underpaid, which we'll discuss on the pod tomorrow, as well as my list of blue chip and red chip players. So speaking of that, I am joined by our great friend, Alex Goldberg, the producer, co-host of the podcast. His videos on Twitter continue to blow up. So Alex, I was writing about the blue chip and red chip players in Serie A. I know we talked about it a while back in the podcast. For those of you that don't remember, basically a blue chip player is an international caliber player, someone who could start for a top team in Europe. So those are, you know, definitely outstanding players. While a red chip player is someone maybe a little bit right below, someone that could start, play regularly for, say, a team like Napoli and Inter this season in Serie A. So I was thinking, Alex, you know, I've been really on the bandwagon that Ventura was a perfect scapegoat. He deserved all the blame that he got with the Azzurri. But two things can be true at the same time. It can be true, and we know it is true, he did a terrible job with the Italian national team, but that doesn't mean that the talent isn't up to par. So let me ask you, Alex, the way I see it, and I'm thinking a little bit long term, because the Euro's in 2 years, World Cup's in four, like who could really be an important player for the Azzurri? And let's not, they have to qualify to two. So, you know, obviously I think Bonucci is still young enough that he can be an important player in 2 years. Chiellini, I don't know. But there's three definites to me. I have Jorginho, Chiesa, and Romagnoli. Am I being too harsh just having these three? Or do you think I'm maybe exaggerating with the lack of talent with the Azzurri?
I don't know if you're exaggerating, David, but I do think maybe we could add on a couple more, at least in my opinion. And a lot of this is based on not necessarily what they've done, but more on what they can do and what I assume they will do. So I would like to add on Bernardeschi. I think Bernardeschi is probably a blue chipper in this conversation, at least for the Azzurri. I think he is one of their more talented players. I think you're starting to see him come into a little bit of his own at Juventus. He was obviously great for Fiorentina, but I do think he's going to have a pretty damn good year for Juventus, even with the likes of Ronaldo and Dybala and Douglas Costa and Mandzukic. I think Bernardeschi is a talent that can't really be ignored much longer. I also think he just looks a lot more comfortable. So I do think Bernardeschi should probably be put in that conversation, at least in my opinion. And then on this one, I have to be biased. I'm going to be biased. I've always liked this player a lot, and I know he has not performed well for Italy, but I still got to throw Lorenzo Insigne in there. I really do. To me, Lorenzo Insigne is in his prime. He's 27 years old. So 2 years from now, he'll be 29 years old. But nonetheless, yeah, he really falters for Italy, but so do a lot of good players. They falter for Italy. And he is one of the best players on one of the best teams in Serie A. And Insigne has been a clinical producer. I can't say necessarily a clinical goal scorer, but between goals and assists, he puts up a nice assist and goal tally for a top team. He's been doing it for a handful of years now. And I still think, David, if you're trying to roll out your best squad, your best current Italy squad, and you want your players firing on all cylinders, you want Lorenzo Insigne in there. So I don't think you're really overreacting. However, I want to add Bernardeschi and I want to add Lorenzo Insigne.
Yeah, those are interesting. And it's I actually included Insigne when I did my list in Serie A with no doubt as a blue chipper for Napoli. He's been you know, one of their three, four best players for sure, which, you know, when you look at Napoli's squad and the performance of their players, it's saying a lot. And I'm going to add to that list Ciro Immobile as well, who I think for Lazio is definitely a blue chipper. We've talked a lot about it on the podcast. Immobile has three seasons with over 20 goals in Serie A. You know, if you do the math and do some research, you'll see that really puts him in some super elite company. And more importantly, you look at some strikers that don't have three seasons with 20 goals. He's definitely a blue chipper. But for whatever reason, and he was particularly dreadful against Portugal. As a matter of fact, he was so bad that I thought Simone Zaza looked pretty good in comparison. So it's kind of a shame, and I'm going to add Verratti to that. Granted, his trajectory, even at the club level, hasn't been that good recently, but for some reason, these are three very talented players that we haven't seen getting the most on the Azzurri. And I want to, you know, a couple of other things, too, that stood out to me on these matches that we saw. I think we can, at the club level, Donnarumma has struggled, but I think he looked really good in these two matches. The other thing that stood out to me on the match yesterday against Portugal is, you know, Gattuso got a lot of criticism for being cautious with Caldara and trying to ease him in. And I think yesterday we kind of maybe saw why. Look, Caldara's done very well playing in big matches for Atalanta, but it's one thing to play those matches with that jersey, another to play with the senior Azzurri squad and Milan. So I'm a big Caldara fan. I think he's going to be good in due time. But I think that was a win for Gattuso. So, you know, in general, I think Bernardeschi, as you said, is a very interesting player because both on the Italian national team and at Juve, there's been talk about potentially moving him to the midfield. And I could see that because I think Chiesa needs to play. To me, Romagnoli, Chiesa, and Jorginho from now on should just start every Azzurri match, no matter what. They need to be in there. They need to kind of become the players to kind of build around. So let's see what happens there. The other thing, too, when a lot of people attack me for saying, oh, there's a lack of talent on the Azzurri, I mean, I just kind of want to remind you, I looked up Italy's squad and when they won the World Cup, and obviously that was a golden generation. But let me read off to you a couple of names of players that were on the bench when Italy defeated France on penalty kicks. And we had De Rossi, Barzagli, Nesta, who was injured, and he didn't start, but Materazzi was such a key player for that team. Del Piero and Pippo Inzaghi. That was Italy's bench. Compare that to the starting lineups. And, you know, let's be fair. Let's not just look at the Portugal one because I think Mancini was just throwing his hands up in the air and just trying a lot of different things. But just compare that to what we saw in the first two matches. To me, the difference is absolutely stunning. If you want to maybe do a closer comparison, you can look at Italy's squad back in 2012 when they made the Euro final. Now, a few people pointed out, and I think it is a fair point, that team was lucky that Cassano and Balotelli were really inspired during that tournament. And we really haven't seen that on the Azzurri from them. But still, you look at those squads, there was definitely a lot more talent.
All right, so David, adding to this discussion, I want to ask you, do you think maybe the lack of blue chippers on the Italian national squad has to do with too many foreigners in Serie A?
So this is very interesting. And, you know, I find numbers and statistics are really fascinating because a lot of them, when you hear a statistic, it just can sound like so authoritarian and something that has to be definitely true. And there was this statistic on how after the 2006 World Cup, there were so many more Italian players playing in Serie A in the first three matches of the season. I think it went down by like 60% now compared to 2006. So you read that stat, you're like, geez, it's obvious. There's not enough Italian players in Serie A. And maybe there's some truth to that. But very interestingly, I saw Sole 24 Ore, which is a financial newspaper in Italy. They quoted this statistic from Transfer Market, which is really interesting on the amount of foreign players in other leagues. So let's compare that statistic that I just read on how there's, you know, percentage-wise, a lot less Italian. But let's see if this trend is happening in other leagues. So this is the raw math. In the Premier League, There's 67% of the players are foreigners. England went to the World Cup semifinal. We have Serie A at 57%, so 10% less than England. There's 10% more Italians. Now, the two teams that won the World Cup the last time, Germany and France, in their leagues, the Bundesliga, 52.5% foreigners. So that's just 5% less than Serie A. And Liga, current world champions, and boy, does France have a lot of talent. And even Germany, I mean, look, they were terrible in the World Cup, but everyone pointed out that they had like three squads worth of players. So they're producing talent. But the Liga has 49.1%. So if you look at Serie A, yeah, there's a little bit less Italians playing in their league compared to Germans and Bundesliga and French in Liga. But the difference isn't so much that you can definitely point your finger to it. So that trend compared to 206, I have a feeling that's true in a lot of leagues, not just Italy. So you got to wonder why those other leagues with equivalent amount of foreigners are still able to produce talent. So I don't think it's quite that simple. I don't think that's the only silver bullet here.
So David, one more question then. How might the Calciopoli scandal affect all of this?
So this was brought up by some Juve fans that I follow on Twitter, and it's an interesting theory. So obviously generations, it takes time, you know, the talent, the players need to play at the top division for a little while. And some Juve fans are like saying, wait a second, is the reason we don't have a lot of good Italians that the Calciopoli scandal happened right after the World Cup, Italy, Juve was relegated. It took a long time for Juve to get back on their feet. They used Italian players, but it wasn't the real Juve. So some Juve fans are saying, you know, Calciopoli was really the Italian Federation shooting themselves in the foot by relegating Juve. And again, for a second, I thought of it and I was like, huh, I wonder if there's something here. But now let's compare that 12 years after that, Juve is using the less amount of Italian players that I can remember in my lifetime. So maybe Juve's decline that and going to second division, maybe that had something to do with it. But it's not like Juve now is like gung-ho with Italian players. And interestingly, yesterday against Portugal, there were no Juve players in the starting lineup. And that hadn't happened since 1998 in a friendly that Italy played in the summer. So interesting observation. I just think there's a lot going on with the reason for lack of talent. I'm actually heading to Italy in the next few days, and that's one thing that I kind of want to learn more about, ask some people on. So we'll talk about this topic more, but I wanted to throw out all these statistics and these points. So another thing that our listeners always throw out to us, and we're very glad that they do, are fantastic Twitter questions. We're ramping up, getting ready for the return of Serie A. So if you have questions on the league returning, we also like questions on music, TV, journalism, podcasting. We have a few of those on this one. Just send them in using the CalcioLand hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, this is an interesting question. Italy's success has never been with the 4-3-3. Should it be time to go back to what has worked historically?
So I got to chuckle. I think it goes well beyond formations. I don't think because Italy won mainly using a 4-4-2 or they did well with a 3-5-2, it has to do with that. To me, again, I go back to the lack of talent. I think the only formation that would really help Italy at this point is a formation that allows them to field maybe 15 players at the same time with the opposition having 11. Short of that, I really don't think that makes a difference.
Okay, fair enough. David, next Twitter question. Who has a higher ceiling between Chiesa and Politano?
It's a good question. At first, I wanted to dismiss it. Well, obviously, Chiesa. But then I wonder, you know, does Chiesa get always a little bit of a bump because he's a figlio d'arte, as we would say in Italy, so the son of a famous player? Do we maybe overrate him a little bit because of his last name? But, you know, I think Chiesa is actually really I could see him being, he might already be the best player on the Azzurri right now. But am I shortchanging Politano by dismissing this altogether? Probably, because Politano was really sensational in the second half of last season. He almost single-handedly avoided relegation for Sassuolo. He's off to a pretty good start with Inter. So I'm going to say Chiesa, but it's closer than my initial reaction was. You know, Chiesa's in a lot of ways an ideal situation. He's the signature player on Fiorentina. They have a talented, exciting squad around them. They're setting him up to succeed. Let's see how Politano does at Inter. Maybe in a few months, this won't sound nearly as crazy as it does now.
All right, David, this is an interesting one. Does Jorginho struggle too much when he's pressed? Will he get exposed when Chelsea face Liverpool and Manchester City?
So I'm going to give my take, and I'm really eager to hear yours. You did an awesome video on Jorginho. So when I got this question on Liverpool and Manchester City, you know, sometimes the bias on the PL, like how a player, it means nothing unless they do it in the PL, unless they do it against the big clubs. I mean, with all due respect to Liverpool and Man City, I mean, Juve's definitely in their league. Jorginho, you know, with Napoli, gave a huge run for their money at Juve in the Scudetto, the race. They went to Turin. They beat Juve. Sure, they kind of didn't keep that momentum going, but they were really outstanding. Jorginho's faced a lot of tough competition, played against Roma a lot. Roma was in the Champions League semifinal. So let's not, you know, make it sound like Jorginho's just played scrubs. And I think, too, there's a lot of overreacting a little bit to Jorginho's matches recently with Italy. And look, he wasn't great, that's for sure. He made a big mistake against Poland, but I think we really need to give him the benefit of the doubt. You guys know I don't like being prisoner of the moment. I don't like to overreact to things. And another Ben Golliver quote that I really like is, you know, don't judge people on their worst day or even just their best day. Like, try to have a bigger sample size. And I think, too, Jorginho, look at his supporting cast on Italy compared to Napoli and Chelsea. I mean, it's stunning, the difference. So not only is there, you know, different supporting cast, it's also he has to get used to playing in this system. And at Napoli, he was the metronome. I mean, Sarri had to build the team essentially kind of around his positioning, passing ability. It's very hard to do that on the Azzurri. And, you know, he's playing alongside Gagliardini, Cristante, players like that, as opposed to Kante, Alan, Hamsik, players of that caliber. So I think way too much is being made about this. I would have full faith in Jorginho, and I just wouldn't overreact to this. So that's my take on it. I know, Alex, you have a lot of thoughts on Jorginho. So what do you think?
Yeah, it's funny because I think the same people who are watching the Italian national team and were not necessarily impressed by Jorginho are in the same boat of Manchester City fans who, after the Community Shield was played before the season started, Jorginho was awful. And all these Manchester City fans who wanted him at the beginning of the summer when all the rumors were hot and heavy that Jorginho was coming to Manchester City, they saw that display in the Community Shield where, David, he was passing it to the opposition. It looked like, in my eyes, he was thinking he was playing with Napoli and he was playing with a brand new Chelsea squad. So he's making a lot of bad turnovers. So everyone was a prisoner of the moment. Even some Chelsea fans saying, oh God, maybe he's not that good. But definitely some Manchester City fans saying, ah, never mind, we didn't want him in the first place, which I think is ridiculous. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there. Is he's playing with players he hasn't necessarily played a lot with. And the way, it's not to say Jorginho can't play in other systems and he can't play with new players. However, as you said, he was the metronome for what Napoli was doing. He was at the point, like a great point guard in the NBA, where he could close his eyes and he would know where his teammates would be. It takes a little bit of time to start adjusting to where your teammates like to be, the tendencies of your teammates. He'll be just fine. He'll be just fine on Chelsea. He's already looking more comfortable knowing where his teammates are in Chelsea. And he'll be just fine on the Azzurri as well. Once they have a little bit more cohesiveness, he is a must play, as you said. Those bad turnovers will actually turn into normal crisp passes once he has a couple more games under his belt with his new teammates. So that's my opinion. So, David, next Twitter question. Let's go to Napoli. Should Napoli be able to play their Champions League matches in Bari?
So you guys know I actually really like Napoli, and I always defend their president, De Laurentiis, because Napoli is really a very different reality than a lot of other clubs and cities specifically. And I think, you know, he has to be aware of who his audience is there, and he has to kind of represent the city. And look, to me, the bottom line speaks the loudest. I think Napoli is as well as run club as there is in Serie A. Tomorrow, when we get into the salaries and whatnot, I'll kind of show you why I think so highly. But I have to say, I find his quotes, especially this summer, have been a little bit even more unhinged than normal. It's almost a little bit Trumpian, like how he's been sounding this summer when people were giving him crap about not signing a big name and then bringing up that Ronaldo was offered to him. He told Napoli fans, "What are you guys complaining about? I'm your big name player." It's like, I just got to chuckle at people buying a De Laurentiis jersey. So he's been quite entertaining, and obviously his feud with Sarri back and forth. But on the Champions League one, this is rather interesting. So for those of you that haven't followed as closely, De Laurentiis bought Bari, who went bankrupt. They're a historic club in Italian football. They actually represent one of the biggest cities in Italy. So he bought them. Same thing like he did Napoli a while back when they went bankrupt. He saw it as a great opportunity, and I think he's done a great job with Napoli. But now it seems that part of the plan was also to maybe use Bari's stadium. And Bari has a stadium that was built during the 1990 World Cup. At the time, it was a state-of-the-art stadium that, at the time, it was great. So now De Laurentiis is saying he feels like because the San Paolo is in such bad shape, not compliant with UEFA, but even beyond not being compliant, he has a big beef with the city on the stadium. He's saying, I'm just going to take... He said today that he petitioned UEFA to bring the game to Bari. So after he made this quote, I saw Paul Joyce, great journalist who covers Liverpool, because Liverpool is going to be playing Napoli at some point in the Champions League. So Paul tweeted, UEFA said it has not received a request from Napoli to move to the CL. And he pointed out that, he doesn't know if Liverpool is actually going to go to Bari for this match. So there's that, where that's already contradicting his other statement. And even funnier, the next statement came from the mayor of Bari, who said, wait a second, the stadium in Bari, that's not compliant with UEFA for the Champions League. So I have to say, I really got a chuckle out of that. Again, I really like De Laurentiis. I'll defend him always. But I'll also, if we can get a good laugh off of football, let's at least try to laugh about these sorts of things.
All right, David, next Twitter question. Who do you think will qualify to finish in the Europa League spots?
So those would be fifth and sixth place in Serie A. So this is actually a pretty interesting race because, of course, last season the top four teams, Juve, Napoli, I think those are pretty good bets to make a Champions League spot, finish in the top four. Inter, you and I, Alex, are pretty high on them. I think they're still a pretty safe bet based on their squad. But after that, it's really pretty wide open. There's Milan, there's Lazio, Roma struggled quite a bit. We'll get into Roma more in the second part of the podcast with our friend John Solano. So for fifth and sixth place, to me, it's going to be two out of these five teams, Milan, Lazio, Fiorentina, Roma, and Atalanta. Torino would like to be thrown into the mix. They've been pretty active in the summer. I'm not sure if they're as good as the others, but you put a gun to my head, I'm going to go with Milan and Lazio.
All right. How about this, David? Is the reason that so many are outraged over the Italian Federation's stance with Astori's armband that Juventus is showing 36 titles rather than 34 in their stadium?
You know, this is an interesting theory, and this has been brought up a lot because Juve's executive director Marotta also had a quote when he was asked about Astori's armband. He said, well, you know, even if we don't agree, we have to follow the rules of the federation. And look, you know, Calciopoli, everyone has an opinion. Nobody's going to change their mind on there. I'm not here to try to change your mind. I'm friendly with Moggi, so I'm pretty partial on this. But I do think it's a very valid theory to say that, you know, Juve's getting away with exposing two titles that were getting revoked, and, you know, the Federation's making a big stink over the Astori armband. So I think this is a very valid theory. If you felt this way, I wouldn't argue with you. I think you'd have a a very reasonable reason to feel that way. Now, I don't think, though, that's the main reason that there's all this outrage over Astori. I think in general, it just looks really bad that a team wants to commemorate their dead captain with his armband and to celebrate him. And it just looks really dopey to have to pay a fine over that. So I think it has much more to do with that. I think this is more after the fact that Marotta's quote, and then people that were already outraged over the Astori thing, then there's this Juve angle, which again, I totally see where people are coming from. So it's an interesting dilemma. If you have an opinion on this, tweet us at Calcioland. I'm definitely curious to get your take. So I'm going to say it is a slight reason, but not the main one.
Okay, fair enough, David. How about this? What do you make of ESPN's coverage of Serie A so far?
Man, I feel like Mike Francesa name-dropping all the people that I know. So, yeah, I mean, I just like to full disclosure. You guys know I'm pretty friendly with Matteo Bonetti. So, you know, I'm kind of partial a little bit. But aside from that, I actually think the service is outstanding with a caveat. If you accept the fact that ESPN bought the rights to really promote their ESPN Plus app, like ESPN has been trying to find a lot of content for their app. ESPN here in the United States, there's a lot of people that are cutting their cable. They used to spend a lot of money on cable. They got rid of cable, and ESPN made a fortune on that. I think they made $8 off every cable subscription. So a lot of people like cutting the cord, as we say here in the U.S., really impacted ESPN's bottom line. And look, I'm partial to because I'm a freelance writer for them, but they've been trying to make up for that with the app, which is $5 a month. You get every Serie A match. You get it in HD. It's an app that actually works. The streams, and I'm an old man, Dave. Even I'm able to play it on my TV very well. They have the games on demand. They have some really good content with the recaps and previews. So look, I think the coverage has been really outstanding. As a Comcast subscriber, BN Sport wasn't even in HD on them. I occasionally watch matches on Rai International where the image, I feel like I'm in the 1960s. You know, when I watch a Premier League game on NBC and then go to Rai International, I feel like I took a time travel vessel and went back 50 years. So in that sense, I find it vastly improved. So I'm a fan, but I understand the caveat. A lot of the matches, and they announce, they show one game a week on ESPN News or ESPN 2. They're not the signature games. Everyone expected that it would be a Ronaldo fest and everyone else would be on the app. And the opposite has been true. We got one game with Ronaldo. But again, it goes back to ESPN's motivation is they give you a little catnip with the game on TV. And then they're like, if you want to watch the rest, $5 a month, and you'll get the app. And I have to tell you, I think that app for $5 is a bargain. I don't say it just because I draw a paycheck occasionally from ESPN, but it's got a lot of great content, even a bunch of boxing stuff. So overall, I think it's really good.
Yeah, I'm thoroughly enjoying ESPN Plus and Matteo Bonetti, of course. All right, David, this next Twitter question's funny. This might sound dumb, but can someone suddenly become a fan of a league or a club?
Yes, and great. I think it's fantastic when this happens. I think, you know, love at first sight is a beautiful thing. If you watch something and you get into it, I love hearing that so many of our listeners came here for the transfers and then stayed for Serie A, then they start watching and they fell in love. So I think you can definitely do that. It happens for me with teams and players like I remember watching Empoli when Sarri was there the first year in Serie A, the way they played. I remember a match when Empoli went into San Siro against Milan, and they were awesome. I fell in love with Sarri on that day. He went to Napoli. I think it's no secret. Last season, we were both, but especially me, rooting for Napoli to win the Scudetto with that style. So absolutely. I think you can definitely fall in love with a league or a team just by watching. And I think that says a lot about you as a person. I think some people have so many preconceived notions and are so stubborn. And if a player is on an opposing team, they can't appreciate it. Like, I hate that stuff. Let it go. If something really intrigue you, don't fight it. Fall in love with it. That's my take on it. How do you feel about this, Alex?
Yeah, totally, David. For me, when it comes to sports, it's all about my heart. The more my head thinks about, I can't be a fan of that team, I can't be a fan of that player, is the moment that I'm really not going to be following what I really want to follow. I think it's definitely probably quicker, in my opinion, to become a fan of the club first, and then the league will transpire. But maybe not. Maybe you like a handful of players from one league, and all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, I like this player on this team, this player on this team, and you're watching a whole weekend of Bundesliga or Serie A. It could be anything random. The less you think about it and the more you just decide, I like this player, I like this club, is the quicker you can fall in love with a league or a club. Absolutely. So, David, this is a funny question coming up next. We have this person's name. Major Keith asks, David and Alex come off as really passionate guys. How often, if ever, do you butt heads about Coucholand, and how is it settled?
So shout out to Major Keith. He's been a big supporter of our podcast, so shout out to him. It's a great question. Look, Alex and I have done a lot of these. This is 152, technically 153 with our preview podcast, and there's been very, very, very little, if anything, on that. If anything, I try to find more ways to get Alex on and to give his takes. He's becoming a big Serie A expert. The only caveat I have, and this goes beyond the podcast, but in general with Alex, and Alex has grown a ton. Like, now his videos are blowing up. Like, there's a lot of people that listen to our podcast right now because of his videos. Because I think Alex is, like, kind of going through a little bit of, like, the phase I had when I was starting to come up with, like, my exposure. I was lucky enough to have a bigger audience. Because after a while, that has to change a little bit. Like, you have to, like, be a little bit more careful. My only feedback on Alex, and I've shared with him many times, and it's come up just once on the podcast, is, you know, you got to try for the most part to be positive, not just totally trash people, especially on Twitter. I think on the podcast, you can get away with it more. It's not even friction, but because I've gone through this. Now, if you notice, it was very out of character for me to trash the Italian national team and their talent, because I haven't tweeted anything negative on a player or coach in a long time, because I've learned that from Di Marzio. Ultimately, there's really not much upside to that. So I was very disappointed if I did that. So that's really my only feedback with Alex. It's just to help him, because I know he's growing a lot. But, you know, considering 152 episodes in, that's pretty remarkable. Am I being too harsh, too lenient? Anything else that jumps out at you, Alex?
No, I totally agree. And it's totally true in terms of the jurisdiction to be too harsh and then positive, because let's just put it this way. It was a lot easier to slam a player when I had 2,000 followers on Twitter than it is when I have what I do now. So that's very good advice. But yeah, we just don't butt heads often, which is great. So David, the next Twitter question, we're going to move away from football entirely. What's your stance on remastered albums? Do you in general prefer the original or the updated version?
There was another question from a loyal listener, Tone. He sent this in multiple times. I was waiting for the right occasion for it. So here's my take on it. And I have to say, the older I get, and we were talking a little bit too when we were talking about the Pearl Jam shows, like, I'm becoming, like, with music, like, I'm starting to break it down like a football game. And I don't know if that's a good thing or not. So I'm really into, like, production now of albums. Both my parents are classical music musicians. I have to say, even just doing the podcast, like, I'm terrible with audio stuff. But I'm starting to be really intrigued by production and all that. So my take on remastered albums is there's some records when they were originally recorded, either the band wasn't very popular yet and they didn't have a very good producer, or they were in a phase in their career where they were maybe a little bit distracted. And both of these apply to Oasis. I think their first album, the production on it is pretty dreadful, and the remastered is much better. And they've had some other albums where maybe they didn't have the best production. They were maybe a little bit distracted. So if it's something like that, I'll always go to the remastered over the original. But there are some albums, and let's think too, like bands that have a very old catalog, like the Beatles, when they do the remasters, obviously it's going to sound really great. I mean, they had one of the best producers ever in George Martin, but the technology has gone better. But if it's something more recent, I'd say from mid-80s on, and the production is really good on the original, I'll just stick with that. I mean, I'm thinking a lot of the albums Bob Rock produced. I think the production's excellent back then, Rick Rubin as well. Sometimes they'll put out remastered albums, and in those cases, I'll listen more to the bonus track than the original. To me, there's just some comfort in how the song sounded originally. So, Tone, thanks for the question. Sorry it took so long to answer.
Absolutely. Big fan of the show. All right, David, last Twitter question. What's your take on Paul McCartney's new album, Egypt Station?
So I love that so many people have tweeted me about this when we did our original podcast, and almost a few times that we had Andrew Barker on. I always like to say, you know, I'm a failed music and movie critic who pretends to be a soccer football pundit, I should say, and writer. Like, that's really my passion. So when people tweet me like music questions, they're like, oh, I really want to know your opinion on this. It's kind of really humbling. So thank you for everyone that send it in on Paul McCartney. So I'm about to go on vacation. There's a lot of albums I want to listen to more, but I got so many tweets on this that since yesterday, I've been listening exclusively to this album, Egypt Station by Paul McCartney, and I'm very, very impressed. Now, I'll tell you, I'm a huge McCartney fan, definitely my favorite Beatle. I think he's the biggest living icon there is on the planet. I think he represents just so much good in the world. So I'm totally in McCartney's bandwagon. But I will say what I really like about this album, it has everything about what makes pop music great. And I'm much more of a rocker, but I can appreciate like a great pop song. And the things that stand out to me about great pop is it has to be catchy, but also have kind of a little bit of a melancholic angle to it, like a song that makes you happy, but also a little bit reflective in a weird way. And I think McCartney's the master of that. And on this album, he really hits a lot of that. There are some poppy, upbeat songs. And there are also some that are very low-key, very reflective. I mean, McCartney's 76, where he's reflecting a lot on his life. So there are some more rock pop songs that are upbeat, that are pretty derivative, too. Like, they almost kind of sound like riffs that you've heard before. And to me, that's another element of a great pop record. And the songs that fall under that, it's called Come On To Me, For You, Who Cares, that are really good. But there are also some other songs that are more low-key, acoustic, and that I really enjoy as well. And there's one of the last tracks that's called Despite Repeated Warnings, which is kind of, to me, shows everything about Paul McCartney. It's like kind of one of the most famous Beatles songs, A Day in the Life, where it's like one part Lennon, one part McCartney, and you can really hear both sides. Like on this song, it's kind of a little bit like that, but it shows all the aspects of McCartney. And I mentioned earlier, I'm really into production. And when I started listening, I didn't look who the producer was or how he recorded it the first time. I just listened to it through. And then I did a little bit of research, and I'm really impressed with the producer he picked. And he's working with this producer called Greg Kurstin, who does a lot of pop stuff. Like, he's worked a lot with Adele, and you can definitely hear that on the album. He's also worked with Liam Gallagher and Beck, who are like pop, a little bit of rock. And he's also worked with the Foo Fighters, so definitely a rock album. And I think he's a perfect fit for Paul McCartney. Like, previously he worked with Radiohead's producer Nigel Godrick, who's probably my favorite producer right now. But like Radiohead, they're my favorite band, but Paul McCartney's got very little, if nothing, to do with that. And I don't know if he was trying to sound more modern by going with Nigel Godrick, but I'm glad he just went back to his roots. And I think this producer, Greg Kurstin, it's kind of like what Rick Rubin does when he works with an artist. He's just like, I'm going to bring you back to what made you great in the first place. So I think it's a great mix. It kind of reminds me a little bit how, like, when Tom Petty finally started working with Jeff Lynne, who was a great songwriter in and of itself. So I really dig what Paul McCartney's done at 76 to still put out such a quality record. Really, really impressive. So I want to thank all our listeners. You guys are great. You guys are co-writers of the podcast with me when you send in these questions. And we also appreciate you guys acting as our marketing department. Please keep promoting the podcast. If you dig what you hear, tag the tweet with the podcast. Tell your friends why you like it. We rely on you to grow. We also really want to thank everyone that left us a review. If you're listening to us on iTunes, on your phone, just go on iTunes, look for Calcioland, scroll down. You can leave us a 5-star rating. We'll literally take you 5 seconds and really help us. And if you want to write a review, Alex and I read them all. So we're going to close the podcast with our great friend, John Solano. There's always so much to talk about Roma. We kind of covered a lot of topics. So let's close it with him. So we were chatting as we were getting ready to record the interview with our good friend, John Solano. And, you know, as I was preparing this interview, it dawned on me that with Roma, there's always so many great storylines to talk about. You know, sometimes they're very good storylines, sometimes not so much, but there's always stuff to talk about when it comes to Roma. And John, by now, you guys know, he's been on our podcast a bunch of times, runs the fantastic IS Roma Press website. The reason I like that one, it's not just an aggregation of all the news from Italy. John interviews a lot of agents, interviews journalists in Italy. You're going to get a lot of great information there. And also his podcast is tremendous. And he also writes on Euro Fantasy Games. So, John, it's a real pleasure to have you on. Welcome back to Calcioland.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
All right. So, John, as I was getting ready, there's so many things that I wanted to talk about. I took some of them kind of in chronological order because a lot has happened since the last time we had you on. So we're kind of a little bit all over the place, but there's definitely a lot of stuff to talk about. So I wanted to start with the Kevin Strootman sale. You and I have talked about this offline a little bit. My perspective is, you know, it probably looks like a lot worse of a deal than it is. I think it's a combination that it happened after the window in Italy closed, so they could spend the money, and Strootman's still a big brand name. So that's my take on that. How did you view the sale, and do you see it as being as bad as Twitter's making it out to be?
No, I think if it were any other club who had made that sale for Strootman, I think it wouldn't have been a big deal. I just think there's a bit of a double standard because Roma tend to sell players at perhaps a little bit of a higher rate than the others. But, I mean, anybody who has watched him over the last few years, this is not the Strootman that we saw in the early months of that 2013-2014 season. If they had sold that player, I would have been irate. That version of Strootman had the makings of sort of a modern-day Toni Kroos. It just simply wasn't the case with him anymore. As David, you're well aware, and we, as you mentioned, we talked about this. I think he's been pretty much a finished player for 3 years now. He's been on the pitch consistently, but if you watch him, very, very slow. I'm not a big statistics guy, as you know as well, David. I don't think you are either. I think the eye test means more than anything. But for his sale, I really had to bring in some statistics to sort of back it up, because if you just look at his passing numbers, he doesn't offer much in the buildup. He can't really score. Tackling-wise, he's okay. And then if you look at his heat map from the past few seasons, it's extremely eye-opening. The guy just can't move. And again, from the way Roma like to play football under Di Francesco, it's just not a good fit. So to me, it was absolutely no big deal whatsoever. Frankly, I was more surprised that Marseille were willing to spend so much on him. That was the biggest shock for me.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you there. Also, the salary that they offered him, I guess for him, you know, it seemed he was really into living in Rome, but for that salary, I guess I would move to Marseille too.
Sure.
So let me ask you about the midfield in Roma in general. So long and short of it, we have Nainggolan and Strootman out. the way I see it, in the short term, those guys are being replaced by Nzonzi, Pastore, and Cristante. And then more long term, there's the potential that Zaniolo and Čorić could, you know, contribute in that midfield. So there's been a lot of turnover. So let's start more with just the veterans. Aside from the brand name and Nainggolan and Strootman, maybe for people that don't watch Roma a lot, might be perceived to be better than what they've actually been. Would you rather have those two or the trio of Nzonzi, Pastore, and Cristante?
Well, just player for player, obviously quality versus quantity. I would rather have Nzonzi, Pastore, Cristante. Now, the only caveat is that Roma's manager is Di Francesco. If Spalletti was still the manager, obviously, I think that changes things because he wouldn't play him in the role that Nainggolan was playing in. Spalletti had him in more of a 10. Di Francesco had him in more of a mezzala role that he clearly did not fit. It was very obvious, anyone who watched more than one match last season, that the way Di Francesco asks his midfield to play wasn't a fit for Nainggolan. Now, obviously, you could find fault in Di Francesco for that, but be that as it may, Di Francesco is a manager. He's going to play with players that, you know, he's going to play the brand of football that he wants. So obviously you want players who fit it better. For me, Cristante has gotten off to a slow start. He didn't look good for the national team the last few days. Pastore, another one. He had that magnificent goal against Atalanta, but he's been having difficulties finding his way into the lineup in the right role for him. And Zonzi, though, for me, has been fantastic. I mean, in his first match, he was sensational. He completely flipped the script when he entered against Atalanta. And then against Milan, he really wasn't that bad. It's just he had that mistake that led to the goal. But if Di Francesco is the manager, then I would rather have the three that are currently on the roster. Really, the only name that you would argue over is Nainggolan, because again, I think Strootman is finished as a player.
Yep, I'm with you there. So now let's talk about the two younger guys who could be part and a very important part of the midfield moving forward. Now, you know, a lot of people like to talk about Santon as part of the Nainggolan deal, yeah, but maybe a little bit less about Zaniolo, who has already been selected to Mancini squad, the senior squad on the Azzurri. Maybe that was more of a message than warranted, but he's a very highly rated prospect. And then we have Čorić. So you follow Roma much closer than I do. Tell me a little bit what the early buzz is on these two.
So it's really confusing on Zaniolo, just because I didn't know what to make of Mancini calling him up. I didn't see him really give much of an explanation as to why he did it either. As you mentioned, he hasn't even made an appearance with Roma yet. So it's a little puzzling as to why he called him up to the national team. But obviously the Azzurri are struggling throughout the pitch. Maybe this was, as you mentioned, perhaps a message to send to the others. For him, I really don't see him playing much this season. I was shocked that they didn't send him out on loan, frankly, because there was interest there. He could have easily gone to Kiev, and I thought that actually would have been a pretty good fit, but it didn't materialize. So I really don't see him having much of a role whatsoever. Čorić, I'm convinced that they're going to do something similar to what they did with Under, where they're really going to ease him in. They're not going to put a lot of pressure on him. The difference is they have a lot of depth in the midfield, whereas now, you know, you don't necessarily have to get him in there. You can allow him to train, get more acclimated with the city, the country, the way of football. Whereas with Under, they really had no other choice because they were so poor in attack last season that, frankly, I think that they put him in there quicker than what they would have liked. He did play very sporadically early on, but once December hit, he was a constant in the starting formation. So I think they want to avoid a situation like that with Čorić. Frankly, I see him playing again very sporadically. He may get a start here and there against the smaller sides. But if I were them, I would be very careful with these two, especially with the struggles early on this season. There's no reason to shoehorn those two into the side.
So now let's talk about a topic you wrote about recently on Euro Fantasy Game, a pretty fascinating topic. So Roma's off to pretty rough start to the season, and we'll get to that. But I want to talk about how this is impacting already speculation on Monchi's future. He's been linked already to Manchester United and Barcelona. Now, I'm not sure if those are exactly the types of clubs I would see him fitting in, but he's obviously a big-name sporting director. So tell me a little bit, what's your take on all this recent speculation? Is it typical drama surrounding Roma, or is there something more to it?
There's always drama. And the thing is, I wrote about the environment being especially toxic in Roma. And I know you've mentioned this before on the podcast more than once, but I'm just telling you, it's one of the most difficult places to win in all of Serie A. It's just the expectations. I mean, you would think this club is of the likes of Bayern Munich. It's just ridiculous at times. So the speculation with Monchi to me is completely unwarranted, unnecessary, and absurd. As you mentioned just a second ago, first off, I don't think he would be a fit at all at Manchester United or Barcelona. I mean, those clubs have just as much pressure, if not more, than Roma. And for the way he likes to work, I just don't understand how he would fit into those two clubs' philosophies. Now, ever since he arrived, he's mentioned that he chose Roma because it allowed him, it was a club that would allow him to be himself and to implement his way of working. I've always found that very interesting because, to me, Roma, a club not, you know, you don't have a huge budget. You have, I mean, it just got out of the Crosera financial fair play. So when I hear him say that, and he said it multiple times, if you go back and look at interviews he's given, he's mentioned and he's given that exact phrase several times. It's very curious. It almost seems like he goes out of his way to mention that. I just think a lot of the pressure that's on him now is a result of the slow start. For me, the majority of the blame should be with Eusebio Di Francesco with the very slow start to the season. For me, Monchi reinforced the squad. In my opinion, I mean, just in terms of on paper, I think this team is better than the one from last season. I do. And I think that a lot of Roma fans were angry and upset with the sale of Alisson, Nainggolan, which each of, you know, all the sales that Monchi made this season, each of them have their reasons. And to me, they're all very logical and make sense. So I feel like he's become sort of the scapegoat to this slow start, which for me, again, is completely unwarranted.
I'm with you there. So now let's get to the start of the season. It feels like a long time ago between the international break and all the drama surrounding Roma after the loss to Milan. So let me ask you flat out, on a scale of 1 to 10, how concerned are you with the start of Roma's season?
On a scale of 1 to 10, right now it's about a 2 or a 3. I am not that concerned at all. Maybe that's been helped, or my worry has been quelled a bit by the other slow starts that some of the other clubs have had. I mean, Juve is the only one with a perfect record. Napoli have struggled at times. Milan did not look good against Napoli. Inter, obviously, we saw how they were in their first couple of matches. So I, you know, just in a general sense, given that those clubs have also struggled, perhaps that's eased my concerns. But it's still very, very early. Di Francesco is still finding the right formation, the right team. So it's still early in September, so I'm not going to panic yet. If they still haven't found their way to play and they still haven't found the best 11 that need to be on the pitch at all times in another month, then I will be gravely concerned because now it feels like Roma, Di Francesco, they're experimenting a bit just to find what is the correct sort of mixture. And until they find that, I won't panic. But if they don't find that in another month or so, then absolutely I will be panicked.
So you pointed this out on Twitter, and I completely agree. You know, there's been a lot of drama on the Strootman sale, which I think got enlarged with the fact that Roma's not off to a particularly good start. So a lot was made on the transfer market for Roma, but you pointed this out, and I agree 100%. The issue is more like the existing players that were on the team, particularly the defense. You know, Manolis has been okay, not great, but Fazio's been really struggling. So give me, expand a little bit on that point that you made, which I completely agree, and zero in maybe a little bit on the defense and what do you think is going to happen there?
Yeah, again, I just think Mochy has become an unwarranted scapegoat in all of this. But if you look at the players that have been the poorest so far, it's been the players that have been there already. If you watch that first match of the season, Fazio, absolutely horrible. Against Atalanta, Fazio again, horrific. Against Milan, despite his goal, Fazio was the worst on the pitch. So I don't know how long you can go with, you know, your starting central defender being one of the worst on the pitch. Kolarov has not looked good as well. He's really, really struggled. El Shaarawy, very, very poor as well. You really don't know what you're getting from him on a certain match. So, frankly, the ones who have struggled the most have, again, been the ones who have been there. And, you know, that's something that absolutely has to change. You know, there's obviously a fairly high turnover rate at Roma. And the players that, you know, have remained are the ones that really have to be the catalyst in moving the team forward. So they're going to be in huge trouble if Manolas, Fazio, Kolarov, if they're the ones who are really struggling. Even Florenzi in his first couple of matches did not look good at all. So my biggest concerns are not at all with the new arrivals. It's with the players that have been in the system before. They know the manager. They know how he wants to play. Yet they're the ones who are by far been the worst ones on the pitch. So that, frankly, I'm more worried about them getting back to form than I am the new players integrating themselves.
Yeah, it was a very astute observation. So now let's talk a little bit about the goalkeeper, Olsen. Like, I thought the first match against Torino, he got a little bit better the second half, but that was one of the shakiest clean sheets I have seen in recent years. Look, he's had some moments where he looked good, but he's also replacing, without a doubt, the best goalkeeper in Serie A last season. That's not his fault, but it does add to the pressure to him. So tell me a little bit about what's your take on what you've seen from Olsen so far.
Yeah, frankly, I don't think he's been that bad. I think he's another one who's been sort of turned into a scapegoat. He's gotten a lot of criticism, especially over this international break. Especially from his home country, the Swedish media have been hammering him, and it's been a little surprising. Listen, he's following, in my lifetime at least, the best goalkeeper that I have seen at AS Roma, without a doubt. So anyone who had to follow Alisson was obviously going to have a tough task, but I feel like he's been so marginalized for absolutely no reason. You mentioned against Torino, he was a little shaky. He was shaky, especially early on in the second half. But anyone who's watched him closely, his reflexes are absolutely sensational, especially for a guy as tall as he is. He can manage his area very, very well. But obviously, he's not good with the ball at his feet. Now, you can blame Monchi for bringing in a goalkeeper like that who isn't great with the feet, but, you know, really good reflexes. That's neither here nor there. The point is, he's the goalkeeper now at Roma. And I do think he's received some unfair criticism. Probably should have stopped the goal against Atalanta. Really nothing he could do against Milan, but he still needs to come into his own. I think he's another one who needs to be given time, but Roma have one of, if not the most highly rated goalkeeping coach in all of Serie A, Savarani. And hopefully he'll have some time to settle, train a little bit, and hopefully he can get his feet under him. But as far as problems go and why Roma have struggled, I could think of three or four other things ahead of Olsen that concern me a lot more.
Okay. So now let me ask you about three players that I find really intriguing because I think they have a lot of upside and they could help, you know, get Roma back on track. So two of them were big acquisitions from last season who didn't play that much because of injuries. So we have Schick, who was injured for a bit, played more in the second half of the season. Karsdorp, I think, played one match after he tore his knee twice and played against Milan, and I thought he was pretty good in that match. And, of course, Kluivert, who's been intriguing off the bench. So if you had to bet which one of these three is going to have the best season, which one would you pick?
I'm going to go with Kluivert. with Karsdorp following just behind him, just because the Roma have nothing on the left wing. El Shaarawy is so just hit or miss. It depends on which day he plays. You don't know what you're getting from him. Diego Perotti, he was a step away from leaving. I have never been a huge fan of his, especially on the left wing. He doesn't really offer much in terms of goal scoring ability. He's not quick. He's a good dribbler. He's not a great crosser, but he can still find a decent pass in the area. Kluivert just offers a dynamic that neither El Shaarawy nor Perotti has. It's just a fact. And I think within the next month, I think he will, without question, be the starting left winger at Roma. He's quick. He can create an attacking opportunity out of nothing. His crossing sensational. He has a better nose for goal than El Shaarawy or Perotti combined. To me, I just think he has all the tools to become a world-class player. And to be quite honest with you, I'm still shocked that Roma were able to land him, because I can tell you undoubtedly the competition that was out there for him was staggering. And for Roma to ultimately land him, I'm still stunned by it, because I think he has all the tools to become a world-class player. So without a doubt, in my opinion, I think Kluivert, of those three, will have the best season.
Okay, so now let's talk another thing that happened since we chatted, is the drawing in the Champions League. And last year, of course, we know how Roma was in the group of death. Nobody gave them a chance. And not only did they qualify, they won it outright. This year, you know, on paper, looks a little bit different. We have CSKA Moscow, Real Madrid, and Plzen, which I'm probably mispronouncing completely. So tell me, what was your reaction once the draw was completed?
You know, initially when I saw Madrid, I was like, oh, God, here we go again. But frankly, when it all was said and done, I thought they had the best draw of any Italian team. I mean, David, you know what Inter and Napoli got.
I think
got.
You can make a great case for that, that's for sure.
I mean, and even Juve, I mean, Valencia has no pushover either. So, I mean, in terms of Champions League draws for the Italian side, I thought Roma made out the best. I mean, if they don't finish second, it's because of their own doing. And I don't think anyone would doubt that their quality versus the two smaller sides is, I don't think there's any argument there. So I think undoubtedly that they should at least be the favorites to finish second in the group. And listen, Madrid have gone, you know, they've overgone a little bit of a facelift as well. Obviously, Ronaldo now playing Juve. I mean, if there was ever the chance to maybe steal the group from Real Madrid, this might be the year. I mean, obviously, with the problems they're having early on this season, you wouldn't tip Roma to do that. But if they can find their feet here, would I be absolutely shocked if they finished first in the group? No, but I guess I also wouldn't be shocked if they finished third or fourth, just given the history of this club and the competition.
So, John, you gave us a lot of interesting things to chew on. You're not that concerned with Olsen, which is interesting. And, you know, I kind of agree he's been a scapegoat. A lot of the issues, Monchi seems to be kind of a punching bag and whatnot. So, as usual, there's a lot of drama and negativity surrounding Roma. And you don't seem to be too concerned. And I think, as you rightfully pointed out, there's plenty of other Serie A teams struggling. But let's end it on something for Giallorossi fans to be optimistic about. What is the biggest reason why you think Roma's going to get out of this slow start and we're going to look back at them getting back on track fairly soon? What's the biggest reason for optimism?
I think the biggest reason for optimism is that last season this club struggled, particularly with their depth. They were very, very thin. They had maybe one or two players beyond the preferred 11 who you could count on. This season, I think they have good options, particularly in the midfield, that can carry them to a better position in the Serie A table. Now, I'm not saying they're going to challenge for the Scudetto, and frankly, is there much of a difference between second through fourth? No, but the problems that we saw last season that had a lot to do with the depth, I think once this team has the time to gel, to find their feet, I just think on paper, they are stronger than last season. Now, will they repeat what they did in the Champions League? I highly doubt it, but I just think in terms of sheer quality that this team is stronger than the one from last season. So maybe they can surprise some people again like they did last season. I just think, again, in terms of depth, I think this club is so much deeper than they were last season.
So, John, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Everyone, check out John's great work on AS Roma Press, especially the podcast. I really enjoy. You get some post-match analysis right in the heat of the moment, some great analysis with excellent journalists, a lot of them from Italy. So, John, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.